93.5 The Tap,
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Israeli warplanes have been pounding the Gaza Strip, reducing buildings to rubble and sending people scrambling to find safety. The sealed-off territory is now suffering severe retaliation for the deadly weekend attack along the southern border by Hamas militants. The scale of what is inflicted on Israel is still emerging.
Mothers, fathers, babies, young families killed in their bed.
Yehuda Gottlieb is a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen who works as a first responder. He was outside Be'eri Kibbutz as Israel's security forces battled the militants. Security camera footage shows the gunmen breaking into the compound and shooting its residents. More than 100 people were killed there.
That's CBS's Holly Williams reporting from Tel Aviv. At least 1,800 people have been killed in Israel and the Gaza Strip. The U.S. says at least 14 Americans have been killed and an unknown number taken hostage. President Biden warning,
any country, any organization, anyone thinking of taking advantage of this situation, I have one word. Don't. Don't.
A major U.S. airline has suspended even more flights to Tel Aviv.
I'm Matt Piper. American Airlines is now suspending flights to and from Tel Aviv through December 4th. The airline says it will continue working closely with its partner airlines to offer assistance to those looking to leave the area. On Monday, Delta canceled its flights there through the end of this month. The State Department has not prohibited travel to Israel or to the West Bank, but says travelers should exercise increased caution.
Embattled New York Congressman George Santos has been indicted on new federal charges in a superseding indictment. He's accused of using individuals' personal credit card information to make unauthorized charges in support of his political campaign. According to the indictment, the victims were previous donors to the campaign. The new charges, including conspiracy, wire fraud, and aggravated identity theft, come days after Santos' former campaign treasurer pleaded guilty and admitted to much of the conduct. More auto workers are walking picket lines. Our Jim Krasula says this time it's north of the border.
Nearly 4,300 unionized workers have gone on strike at three General Motors plants in Canada. The walkout came after the union said GM refused to match a contract proposal from Ford that offered wage increases of up to 25% in Canada.
Lydia has become an extremely dangerous Category 4 hurricane with winds of 140 miles per hour as it takes aim at Mexico's Pacific Coast resort of Puerto Vallarta. Deadly bird flu reappears in U.S. commercial poultry flocks in Utah and South Dakota. This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed, because Indeed's all-in-one hiring solution helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. A trial date has been set in the lawsuit against a man convicted of hitting and killing several Girl Scouts with his pickup truck. Colton Trow was said to have lost control of his truck after he had been huffing aerosol fumes, killing three Girl Scouts and one of their mothers, and injuring a 10-year-old girl. Trow is being sued for medical costs, lost wages, and emotional damages. Walmart is also included as a defendant, as it's believed Trow bought the aerosol cans from one of their stores. The trial is set to begin in February. Authorities are still looking for a reported missing boater in Polk County. The Polk County Sheriff's Office announced they received a 911 call on Monday about a boat going in circles on Cedar Lake and a woman yelling for help. The woman was pulled out of the water and reported there was also a man and a dog on the boat, but authorities have thus far only been able to locate the dog on the boat. The search is ongoing and boaters are advised to stay off the water. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Holler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. sense. The pin still set by people? Swear, and you're tossed out. The ants are coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pin still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. This includes a commitment to news. Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
Share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. It's another day of people who hate America showing their true colors and voicing it loudly. The Iranian legislature cheering death to America. That made the rounds on social media. You had Vladimir Putin saying that the attacks by Hamas are our fault. Somehow he said that. It's clear, a clear example of the failure of U.S. policy in the Middle East for not taking the core interests of the Palestinian people into account. And of course, the Republican Party blaming Biden. It's all Biden's fault. It's all Biden. Everything's Biden's fault. Never mind the fact that 4 years under Trump and Jared, because Jared was going to, you know, he was the Middle East master. He did it all. And of course, you got Tim Scott, which is weird. Tim Scott has been kind of I think he believes this is what's going to get him some attention as he runs for president. He believes that it's all Biden's fault. Everything's Biden's fault. And that he, again, alone, like Trump, can fix it. Now, he had an interesting comment. He argues that America needs to return to a policy of strength. And I don't know what the heck he's talking about. There's a part of me that goes, okay, I get you believe that you know, right now we're weak. I know you believe that. That somehow our military, you know, very weak. Somehow, you know, just the change of a name on the door of the White House, that makes the military weak. You know, all the training they do, all the, you know, the command, all that. I kind of get it, but I don't know what the return to a policy of strength is. What are you going to do? What do you mean by a policy of strength in this situation, looking at Israel and Hamas and, you know, the whole Middle East, do you mean putting boots on the ground? Are we going in? Are we suiting up? Are we getting involved? Are we going to start dropping stuff? Is that what you mean by a policy? Because I actually have no idea. And I don't think any of these people do either. because I haven't heard any. I haven't heard any. Hey, this is the way forward. I've heard he's the problem. It's Biden's fault. I've not heard anyone say this is how we fix the problem. Hey, look at me. I have the answer. I've heard a lot of people say, well, if it were me, I wouldn't. They wouldn't have done this because, well, at least the one orange guy. Again, no plan, no plot, no idea, no vision, no thoughts, just rhetoric. I did find it cute that Fox News, blaming Joe Biden, blamed Biden for... how did one of the hosts put it? For the lack of Senate confirmed elected officials? That was verbatim. It was Biden's fault for not having, for having a lack of Senate confirmed elected officials. And you look at that statement and you go, well, elected officials are elected. Senate confirmed officials are Senate confirmed. That's the nature of advise and consent. The president who is elected, an elected official, he puts forth a nominee. The Senate advises and consents. And that's how that they get confirmed. That's how this works. But we're in a moment where the Republicans, in their role of advising and consenting, are not. And you look at Tommy Tuberville, the dumbest guy in the Senate, who since February has had a near total blockade on any confirmations of military officers. Well over 300 military officers are waiting for their confirmations. And it turns out this little thing in Israel, this whole dust up over there, that's not going to move him to lift the blockade of our military nominations. No, especially when you have Tim Scott saying, you know, we need policy of strength. Someone want to tell them that this is kind of the time when we need functional government, when we need adults in the room to do their jobs? I don't know. But look, it's not this idiot Tuberville. It's most of them. I look at J.D. Vance. He's had a hold on DOJ nominations for a while because they indicted Donald Trump. Well, we'll show you. We're not gonna let you do your job. We're not gonna appoint anyone. Josh Hawley's had a hold on what? On people at the Department of Energy because something with radioactive waste in St. Louis that he who even knows. Chuck Grassley's got a hold on the Deputy Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Again, I don't even think he knows why. Rand Paul had a two-month hold on the State Department nominees because of documents he believes existed, who knows, over COVID. And you've got Fox News blaming Biden for not getting people confirmed? When we've got these idiots in the Senate? And look, you got, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste. You know, Josh Hawley floated the idea of cutting off funding to Ukraine so they could give it to Israel. And of course, you know, good on one of the people who survived the attack, basically saying, what are you, stupid? And the answer is, yeah. This person, you know, tweeted back, what a cynical move that you would do this. Shame on you, Senator. Iran is sending drones to Ukraine and guns to Gaza to murder Ukrainians and murder Israelis. God help us if USA can't support both countries against this brutal anti-democratic axis. Glad Biden is in charge. And I gotta tell you, I absolutely agree. Because here's the thing. I fear authoritarianism is on the rise. I fear the wannabe dictators, the people who would side with Putin, the folks who are doing Putin's, carrying of the Putin water. You know, our Republican friends. You know, it used to be, and you know, we talked about this yesterday a little bit. It used to be these kind of divides stopped at the water's edge. You know, we beat each other up over, you know, internal stuff, over family stuff. But when it went out into the international community, we had a sense of strength. When there was an attack, we came together. I fear in a moment of heaven forbid, another 9/11 type attack, it's not a moment of unity. It's not a moment of, hey, let's all pull together and be one. That it then becomes used against, hey, they're not American enough. And it's used by some. I'm looking at the orange guy as an opportunity to consolidate power, to set aside democratic norms, to overstep institutional policy, to grasp control. And look, we've had our moments in this country of interesting kind of dealings. And today I had a conversation with someone who reminded me, you know, because we were talking about Iran, we were talking about the Middle East, and brought up the idea, the 1980 election, and brought up the fact that, and we now know to be accurate, that the Reagan campaign had something to do with the people who were holding the hostages in Iran. And it used to, my whole life, it was a conspiracy theory. You know, George H.W. Bush, who was head of the CIA, you know, hold on to them a little bit longer, you know, let them go as we put our hand in the Bible. It's a good image. It's a Hollywood movie. It's well scripted. And it was such a great myth. You know, the Gipper puts his hand on the book and the world shivers. It was such a good narrative. The sad reality is I fear that kind of narrative making isn't for good. And as we move forward, it becomes something that is used to destroy democracy across the globe. And as I said yesterday, I don't have the answers on what's going on in Israel and with Hamas and the Palestinians. I know a lot of poor people are going to die. I know there's going to be misery. I know we're going to see horrible atrocities all over the place. And nobody has a solution. Nobody seems to be coming forth with, hey, this is what we do. It's now all about feeding your confirmation bias. And that's what's frustrating to me. In our news media, it's all about the clicks. It's all about the attention. It's all about the, hey, look over here. All the while, poor and working class people around the globe are getting poorer and more desperate and more divided. For me, that's where this is. Instead of going, hey, there's a way forward, we're siding up into teams. Want to hear your thoughts. Lots to get to on this, lots to talk about. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Help the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, still don't have a speaker. And again, this is another one of those moments where, you know, the globe is in chaos. People are looking to the U.S. for leadership. And, well, welcome to chaos. Hakeem Jeffries has been renominated as the Democratic leader, the candidate for Speaker by the Democrats. Republicans still, who knows? We will see. Let's go to the phones. Got Steve in Chicago on one. Steve, how are you today?
Yes, I'm fine, all things considered. And I think that you made a really great point with regard to media, because you can't have this discussion without talking about that. And the reality is that though people may want to sort of idealize what media is supposed to be, it's not a bunch of people who are journalists working for a news outlet that's bringing you what's going on in the world. No, that perhaps was at one time what some of them did. Today it's about bringing you to advertisers. And unfortunately, given the nature of these large media organizations and conglomerates, it's just the case that it's about the bottom line. So it's not always that they have some agenda in terms of getting someone like a Trump elected or someone else. It's just that the kind of soundbite-ish quality that defines modern media, you know, we live in this Twitter-esque society, I guess, what is it, X now?
Yeah.
You know, I always thought that, well, who in God's name would want to have a Twitter account? I never had one. Why? Because you can't get a coherent thought out in that many characters. So why would I want one? Yet, you know, a lot of people buy into it, and I understand people have careers, and they need to be on social media, so they need to be on there. But honestly, what does it do for you in terms of, you know, enlightening you about what's going on in the world? And that caters to the conservative mind. So, and so in this alternative universe of their media, you can actually articulate a position that says that it's Joe Biden's fault that Republicans refuse to confirm his nominee. I mean, that's just an alternative universe.
Yeah.
And they believe it, and because they know that a lot of their voters don't do anything about this with regard to being intellectually curious, looking it up, doing a little bit of research. No, no, no. We'll just go along with their narrative, and that narrative says Joe Biden is to blame. And why? Because some conservative outlet told me that, you know, he couldn't get his people into office. He couldn't get them in office because Republicans refused to confirm them, for God's sakes. But that requires, you know, 2 seconds of research. So, yeah, it's frightening because, you know, one of the things that we've learned in the last few hundred years about democracy is that for it to function properly, people actually have to take the time out of their lives to do something with regard to becoming educated voters, because stupid voters lead to bad government. And I would love the idea, there's part of me at least that would love the idea that only the best and brightest would vote. We could pick 100,000 of the best and brightest people in the country, and they would decide who would run our government. But that's not democracy. So instead, we allow everyone to cast a vote. I spent 12 years of my life after I graduated high school earning 3 different degrees, including a doctorate in political science. I would contend that I know something more than most people about the field, but that doesn't mean that my vote counts any more than anybody else's. But on anything else, if you were to ask, what are we going to do about this patient who has heart disease? Well, the guy over here is a cardiologist. What he thinks matters more than what 20,000 other people who have no such credentials think. And the same thing with regard to law, the same thing with regard to economics. I mean, you could just go down a long list of things. We always have this belief that it's perfectly legitimate to defer to people who know what they're doing in most fields. Yet when it comes to public policy, apparently everybody's got an opinion, and everybody's opinion is supposed to carry equal weight.
Yeah.
No, that's not what it means. You have a right to free speech in this society. You don't have a right to your own facts. And that's so there is such a thing as radical egalitarianism, and unfortunately, a lot of media, they've been played as, you know, by the reps, as it were. So it's this idea that, well, you know, we're all liberals, and if you're part of the media, then you're catering to liberals. So you know what? As Republicans and conservatives, we're going to work the reps, and we're going to make sure that our voice gets heard as much as the other side, despite the fact that what we're trying to say is ludicrous. You know, I mean, I'm sorry, but you don't sell, you know, geography next to flat earth science for a reason, because those are not things that are equally debated. You can have a debate about the top marginal tax rate. Two people can agree to disagree on what that should be. But there are some things which are just settled. And unfortunately, that's not what we see in media today. There are just the most crazy conspiracy theories out there. Alex Jones had a following that was larger than a lot of cable news outlets at the height of his career. And we all know what he thought. you know, with regard to what was going on in the world. So, yeah, this is an epistemological crisis that exists in this country. And until we address it, I don't know how we're going to change the direction in which we're moving.
Yeah, I don't know. Is that whole flat Earth thing, is that settled? Because, you know, I walked into a classroom recently and they had a globe and a map on the wall. So there was the round one and the flat one. I don't know.
Well, you know, I mean, and I use that example specifically because since the age of social media took hold, the number of people has quadrupled in terms of who believes that the Earth could potentially be flat. And they're getting this exactly from these places. They'll go on to some ridiculous site on YouTube or somewhere else, and someone will tell them, look, this is the science. It's not science what they're offering. It's some ridiculous idiot who thinks that this is science. Yeah. It can be disproven in 2 seconds. But people buy into it, and all of a sudden, if you believe the Earth is flat, I think you're pretty harmless. But if you think that the vaccine is going to sterilize you, COVID vaccine is going to sterilize you, if you think the election was stolen, yeah, those things actually have a potential to harm the society in which you live. That's dangerous, unlike the flat Earth belief nonsense. Yeah. So that's the problem.
Now, the thing that gets me is, you know, the flat Earth folks, and a lot of the conspiracy folks, you know, they do their research. And you, as someone who has advanced degrees, actually knows what research is. So one of the things out of the pandemic that I find most offensive and most ridiculous is this phrase, do your own research. Because I don't think we in this country actually know what research is. You know, we had a guest on the show not too long ago who said, you know, doing research isn't, you know, sitting on the can with your mouth open watching YouTube videos. And I agree with that. That's not research.
Exactly. We teach kids in high school that when you're going to write your first research paper, so, you know, if you hope to go on to college, this tends to be part of the curriculum, you know, you can't use something like a secondary source. In other words, the New York Times, as great a newspaper and a journalistic outlet as it is, it is not considered proper sourcing. It is a secondary source. So, yet we have people in this country who think, as you point out, YouTube videos. I mean, we can't use the New York Times for high school students isn't legitimate, but other people think YouTube videos are. Now, you're not an adult, so when we say, you know, you need to do your own research, okay, great, if provided that people understand what methodology means and what research and statistical analysis means and what's good and what's bad, you know. Yeah, when Fox News does a poll and says, okay, our viewers, go and tell us what you think about this. Okay, that there's a problem there. It's a self-selection problem. The people watching Fox News are not representative of this country. So when they say 80% of our viewers reject what Joe Biden has offered up in this public policy initiative, well, yeah, because it's Fox News viewers. It's not American.
Yep.
And somebody will say, well, this is what the Fox News poll said. Yeah, again, because you don't understand research methodology.
Yeah, but they do, and this is the part that gets me. They do understand it. They don't care. It's all about, again, back to the Les Moonves comment. You know, you know, Trump may be bad for America, but he's good for the bottom line.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm hoping that moving forward, that some of the media in this country actually sit down and have a discussion and say, you know, what we did in 2016 in service of the bottom line was not in service of this society and our democracy.
Yeah, don't hold your breath.
And just because Donald Trump says it, and just because he says it, and just because people are willing to watch it, and it'll boost our ratings, does not mean we have to air it. So let's have that discussion in those newsrooms. But I'm wondering who's got the guts to do that.
None of them. It's all about the bottom line. It's all about the money, Steve. And I think you know that as well as anyone.
True. Take care.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much. No, I have these conversations often, you know, as, you know, doing what I do. And this is not a news program. I'll be the first to tell you that. I am not breaking news. I am not, you know, not telling. I'm looking at news and I'm telling you what my thoughts are. This is about me as much as it is anything else. I want our news people to be unbiased as much as they can. I want them to present reality, but I also want them to say this is BS. There's nothing to corroborate the lies and insanity that come out of some of our elected officials' mouths. There is a moment where, and as I've been saying for some time now, Republicans are lying a little differently right now. You know, politicians have always lied to us, and I've been saying this for a while. They've always lied in certain ways. They've always spun reality, twisted into a pretzel. But there's always been that kernel. There's always been that grain of salt that's going, yeah, this is the fact. I look now and I'm not finding that grain of salt anywhere. I'm finding just total BS from a lot of these people because they've spun their own alternative reality. How you come up with the flat earth stuff, beyond me. How you come up with a lot of the Q stuff, well beyond me. You know, I've had conversations with the red hats who believe that in every classroom there's a cat box, you know, that, you know, at lunchtime they've got transition services, you know, right in the schools. I mean, the things that my red hat friends believe are incredulous. It's I don't know how you get there. Well, I do. You're submersed in Fox, in OAM, in Newsmax, and worse. You're the flat earthers. Only worse. Hopefully we do better. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I got a lot to get to. When we come back, Scott Paul is going to be here to share some thoughts on our trade numbers, our job numbers, and much more. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was the day mill workers began to walk off the job at the Phoenix and Gilbert Knitting Mills in Little Falls, New York. The strike was sandwiched between the Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and the 1913 Patterson Textile Strike. American, Hungarian, Polish, and Italian workers, over 70% of them women, struck against wage reductions. Their hours had just been cut from 60 hours a week to 54, and their wages adjusted accordingly. A recent Factory Inspection Commission investigation revealed deplorable working and living conditions, among the worst in the state. As a result, state legislators passed protective legislation restricting women's work hours. Many social reformers pushed for laws like these in the hopes of improving women's quality of life by minimizing their exploitation on the job. But the reduction in hours spelled disaster for these mill women, who then faced a loss of income that ranged between 75 cents and $2 a week. Socialists in nearby Schenectady, including the socialist mayor George Lunn, arrived in town and were promptly arrested for giving open-air speeches in support of the strikers. IWW organizers soon followed to help organize picketing, daily strike parades, and strike committees for each of the factories. They quickly established IWW Local 801, the National Industrial Union of Textile Workers. By the end of the month, mounted police closed in on the women strikers and began clubbing them, many into unconsciousness. The police raided strike headquarters and arrested IWW strike committee leaders. But the women strikers stood strong and were celebrating victory by the end of the year. They won full reinstatement and 60 hours pay for 54 hours work. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Over time, words with beautiful meanings occasionally get degraded into ugliness. Gentle, for example. Originally meaning good-natured and kindly, it was twisted into gentry in the Middle Ages by very ungentle land barons seeking a patina of refinement. Then it became a pretentious verb to gentrify, meaning to make something common appear upscale. And now the word has devolved to gentrification, describing the greed of developers and speculators who oust middle and low-income families from their communities to create trendy enclaves for the rich. The latest move by these profiteers is their meanest yet, targeting families with the most tenuous hold on affordable shelter, people living in mobile home parks. Some 20 million Americans, especially vulnerable senior citizens, veterans, the disabled, and immigrant workers, make their homes in these inexpensive parks. Well, inexpensive until the vultures sweep in, including multi-billion-dollar Wall Street powerhouses like Blackstone Group, Apollo Global Management, and Carlyle Group that are buying up hundreds of trailer parks across the country. These are easy for unprincipled speculators to grab. While tenants might own their mobile homes, they rent the lots, and the first sign that a huckster has taken over a neighborhood park is an unwarranted spike in everyone's rent. Residents are captive tenants, for these homes are not really mobile, and even if one can be moved, the cost can top $10,000. New Yorker magazine notes that today's typical mobile home park has been called a waffle house where customers are chained to their booths. Corporate predators are steadily driving out lower-income families, then remaking the parks to attract upscale owners of million-dollar mobile homes. This is Jim Hightower saying, and where do former tenants go? Away. Out of sight, out of mind.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I tell this all the time whenever I talk about manufacturing. I've been through Trenton, New Jersey. You know, when I was on the road, I used to go through Trenton all the time. We had a terminal there. And we always went over that bridge that had on the side of it, Trenton makes the world tanks lit up in real bright lights. Sense of pride for the community. Sense of pride for the country. Because we used to be the manufacturer of the globe. We used to make stuff. Lots of stuff. Not just stuff for ourselves, but stuff for everybody else. Stuff we shipped around the world. Again, sense of pride. When I was a kid, blue jeans in the Soviet Union was the thing. Everybody, American blue jeans were just... Now, good luck finding a pair of American-made blue jeans. But I saw this story about building big ocean vessels. Evidently, we produced just 10 of these big ocean vessels last year, where China, 1,000. Understand, we used to be, again, number one. We used to be the commercial shipbuilder of the world. Not anymore. I guess we've fallen to, 19th? And here to share some thoughts on it. Well, how did this happen? And how do we return to, probably never going to get back to number one, but how do we, at least build what we need? Domestic production for domestic consumption. That's why I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Good to be with you.
So what do you make of this? Just 10 of these big kind of ship thingies. So what are we talking about? Oceanic vessels. What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, these are the container ships. I mean, these are the big boys that get cargo around the world. And we depend on it for getting exports out of the United States. And also, we obviously import a lot of goods, as we've discussed. Some of those, we really do need. And the challenge is, unfortunately, that with respect to the shipping, we don't control our own destiny because we just don't make these things anymore. And that has spillover effects into the military sector as well. It's just a loss of innovation, a loss of know-how, a loss of repair capacity. And Rick, you teed it up perfectly. I mean, the disparity with China is just enormous. I mean, the fact that we're a country that our main, military strength for really all of our history has been measured in terms of the tonnage of our Navy, right? And we built it up, and we had the biggest Navy in the world. We had an enormous merchant marine. We had two oceans between us and the nearest adversary. But it was that merchant marine and that Navy that really helped to project our soft power and our hard power. And the truth is that we have been in relative decline for decades, both on the merchant marine, the civilian side, which coincides with subsidies for shipbuilding ending in the Reagan administration, by the way. And on the military side, too, where we have just, we've downsized the number of shipyards that we have working in the United States. And, China's scaled up its Navy big time. And so we have kind of these dual challenges that we have to face, because I get very uncomfortable if we don't have some control over our own destiny here. And we're losing that right now.
No, I mean, I look at this, and when I saw this, my first thought was obviously, as you pointed out, right to military, right to national security. Thought back to stories my grandfather told me of, turning the old IX Center in Cleveland into a tank plant. I forget what it was beforehand. Turning the auto industry into, they made planes and tanks and all kinds of weaponry for World War II. we don't have that manufacturing capacity anymore. And to go from, you know, being able to be the world's producer of these large vessels, these ships, to now being, you know, 19th with the capacity of building just 10 of them. I look at the chaos in the world. I look at the chaos here at home, and I'm concerned about the future.
Yeah. Yeah. And rightfully so. And this isn't just about national security. This is also about jobs and skills and capabilities as well. And the fact that we have a limited capacity to repair vessels. In fact, we can only do about 36% of the demand out there for the repair, or that we've downsized the shipyards, means that the number of people who possess the skills to do this is frighteningly small. And it's not the workers' fault. So let's be clear about that. It's just because we have really downsized the sector. And so scaling it up, and you just mentioned this, and, you know, God forbid we need to do that, but we may. You look at the world and you're absolutely right. We have to be prepared to do that. And the fact is, we would be woefully unprepared right now if we needed to scale up construction either of our merchant marine. If for some reason China said, well, we're just not going to use our ships to carry your goods anymore, right? Or our Navy. And so, you know, it's a, you know, 10 ships a year compared to 1,000. I mean, that kind of output, anybody can do the math and know, even if we have the technical superiority, the volume is going to catch up with us, and we definitely have a long way to go.
And that's just this one thing. How many other things did we used to manufacture for ourselves, produce for ourselves, that we were the global leader in, that we've given away? And I no longer say we've lost, you know, manufacturing jobs. We've lost manufacturing capacity. We didn't lose it. We know exactly where it is. We gave it away.
That's right.
And how much of it is, because, you know, I argue with friends about this all the time. How much of it is, you know, it was the end of history after the fall of the Soviet Union. We thought, hey, you know, now the globe is a safe place. We can all trade with each other, and people who trade with each other don't fight. And, you know, rice and beans and all that garbage we were taught in economics course. So, you know, the world is corporate America's oyster, and them moving. And how much of it was just corporate greed, where they're just going, hey, screw America. We're going to go find cheap exploitable labor and lax environmental regulations so we can fatten our bottom lines. Or was it all of the above?
Yeah, I think it is all of the above. It's a little bit of that wishful thinking. It's a little bit of that greed and that misguided philosophy that if you have strong economic relations with countries, they'll never fight again, which has turned out not to be true. And so yes, we let it slide. And even before that, you know, when, you know, Reagan ended the shipbuilding subsidies because he thought it was against free market, not understanding that, you know, shipbuilding, merchant marine, that's like a public good as well, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that comes out of that. And so we really eroded that capacity. Rick, I do think, look, there are a couple of encouraging signs, you know, despite all of these horrible stories we've been telling. And that is that I think that there's some recognition that this is a problem. And for instance, we recognize it with semiconductors, and now there's a program to construct semiconductor factories in the United States. And it is very successful. It's doing exactly what it's intended to do. It's scaling up a massive amount of semiconductor manufacturing in the United States. I would argue that there are other sectors where it's important that we do that. I think pharmaceuticals is one. I think we ought to make more of our pharmaceuticals. I think shipbuilding is one, because we have both the civilian and the military need for a modern fleet. And simply being able to churn out 10 ships a year compared to 1,000, that is a real problem. But I think that we know that if we invest some resources in it, that we can make this happen. But we have to have the political will and to do that. And we also have to, you're right, Rick, challenge those corporations who are just interested in making bigger margins, bigger returns for their shareholders, not taking into account the impact that that's having on our economic and national security in the United States, nor facing any consequences for that.
The consequences being the important part. You know, I've had a lot of conversations recently about people with corporate America going, oh, we need to, you know, we need to ask them to do nice things. And, you know, basically, you know, asking them to be benevolent. And I don't believe in benevolent corporate leaders. I don't believe in benevolence. I believe in the carrots and sticks. Yeah. I believe in getting people to do what they need to do. And if they don't, you know, holding them accountable. Which is why I look at what we've allowed corporate America to get away with. They were bad policy decisions. And as you pointed out, thank you, Ronald Reagan, for helping destroy the shipbuilding industry by gutting the subsidies. And again, it's that ideology that I believe they knew even then as they were pushing. They knew what they were doing. They were destroying the industries here so that they would go elsewhere, so that they could pocket more money, destroy unions, destroy the prosperous working class, and take back... get us back to desperation where we are now. But that's a whole nother argument. But bad policy got us here. Good policy can get us out.
Yes, and that is absolutely correct. I do think that with the right industrial policy, we can reinvigorate industries like shipbuilding. That, again, everybody takes it for granted. No one thinks about this until there's a problem. But when there's a problem, it becomes a massive problem.
Yeah.
And if it's a matter of we're not able to replace the Navy ships out there and we're getting into a hot situation, that is not when you want to test this theory, right? Or if China says, you know what, we're going to keep the merchant marine for ourselves and y'all are going to have to figure out another way to get goods around the world. And again, this may not be a likely possibility, but it is something that you cannot discount. And so under either of those scenarios, we are not prepared. And again, when we saw this with semiconductors, we said, okay, let's do this. And it was bipartisan. There were Democrats and Republicans who said, look, let's put this together. And now we have a policy, and now we have new semiconductor factories all over the country. You know, in Arizona and Indiana and Ohio and Texas and New York and a bunch of other places, too. So let's reinvigorate the shipyards. We have four of them. Let's get four more open. Let's get a new generation of shipyard workers who, by the way, are unionized, which is awesome in most parts of the country. And let's put them to work and let's build some more ships so that we have more control all over our own, you know, merchant marine destiny and our, you know, U.S. Navy destiny as well. Yeah. And I think we'll be better off for it.
Yeah. And it's not just about, you know, the ships themselves. It's about everything that goes into them as well. I mean, think of absolutely all the steel and all the, you know, the aluminum and the rubber and, you know, everything that goes into this, all the machined parts and all of the potential industry that could spur around that we've lost. It's not just the capacity of putting it together. It's everything, all of the inputs. It's all of this stuff that could revive an industrial base. And the reason I bring up the military, and you rightfully so said, you know, it doesn't always have to be military. I believe the only reason we do things in this country is military. I think that's the only reason we have urgency. You know, but you go back 100 years, the only reason we got school milk programs is because kids were, you know, healthy enough to carry weapons into war. So we got milk programs into schools. If we can't get milk into the classroom, you know, without talking about weapons, ships are far down the list. So for me, if it gets us our industries back and it gets us moving in the right direction, I think that's what we got to talk about.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so my hope is that there'll be more attention that's paid to this issue and that we aren't afraid to explore the solutions like we did with semiconductors to both push back against unfair trade practices because it's allowed China to dominate this global industry, but also the fact that we've had this paucity of domestic investment, that's hurt us too. But again, we know the formula. We know what will work here. We have to execute it.
Now, one of the things you and I have talked about for years is just how bad our trade deficit is, you know, not just, you know, with the world, but especially with China. And yet there has been a pretty sizable decline in trade in our trade deficit with China. And look, I want to trade with China. I want to have good relations with China. Nobody wants an enemy there, but you can't keep being in the dumping ground for the Chinese communist government to be able to dump, you know, cheap garbage here.
Yeah.
But I guess a year over year down a third. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean it's an interesting development, and there's a couple of things that we can draw from this. First, is that there is a very real kind of de-risking that's happened. Okay, and so there is less being pulled directly out of China, and coming from other countries like Vietnam, Mexico, instead. So you see that. Okay, that's number one. I think number two, and I think this is something we have to keep our eye on, is that I think the Chinese government and Chinese companies connected to the government are aware of the sensitivity of this trade deficit or of this. And so they're also playing some games and routing products through other countries. And we've seen this. And so, you know, we also have to look along with those, the change in the trade flows, as, you know, follow the Chinese investment too. And if it's just a, you know, Chinese investment in Mexico, and we're seeing that product coming from Mexico, but it's from the Chinese company, that's, you know, that's still of concern, I think, in a number of ways. But the trend is real. That number is coming down. I'd like to see our overall trade deficit come down that much. We're not there yet. We're not at 33%. But we have a, you know, both the tariffs that were put into place in the last administration, some of the domestic investments we've seen, and then some of the companies realizing that their own investments in China aren't necessarily secure, along with the Chinese government knowing that, you know, we gotta start playing the whack-a-mole kind of shell game a little bit, I think has contributed to this dynamic. And I don't think it's reversible. I think it's going to continue to head down a little bit. But that doesn't mean that unfair trade practices, subsidies, Chinese investment isn't a problem anymore. It's just shifted, I think, to maybe other areas of the world.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I'm thrilled with what Joe Biden's doing. I'm thrilled with the fact that we've got something of an industrial policy. We're reshoring manufacturing. We're having conversations about domestic production for domestic consumption. I think we're heading in a good direction, something we need to continue. But I'm sure it's something that we'll talk about down the road as things continue. I appreciate the time, Scott. As always, good stuff. Appreciate it.
Likewise, Rick, thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Our good friend Scott Paul. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Scott Paul is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Gonna take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come the talk.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1913. At 2:02 in the afternoon, President Woodrow Wilson at the White House touched off an explosion at the Gamboa Dike in Panama. With that touch of a button, the last barrier to joining the waters of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans through the Panama Canal went up in smoke. The Chicago Tribune described the scene in Panama, writing, quote, "Then suddenly came the muffled roar of the discharge of 1,600 pounds of dynamite, which sent a shower of water, mud, and rock high into the air. Spreading out as it went upward, the whole heavily veiled into a cloud of smoke. As water began to pour through the rent made by the explosion, the crowd sent up a great cheer. It was a noteworthy moment in the construction of the canal. But that moment came at a staggering cost of workers' lives. For more than 20 years, the French and then the United States worked on the canal project. The U.S. phase lasted for a decade. As many as 45,000 workers toiled on the canal during the peak years of construction. These workers came from the United States, Europe, Asia, and Panama. West Indians formed the core of the work crews. These workers faced stifling heat, brutal working conditions, and poor accommodations. Workers had to contend with ravaging disease, poisonous snakes, and torrential rains. Workers also faced racial discrimination. For example, West Indian workers earned half the hourly wages of U.S. and European workers. They also lived in much more crowded barracks. Worker deaths were so frequent that death or funerary trains made continual runs to bring the bodies away from the construction site. It is estimated that more than 27,000 men died building the canal. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I had the weirdest thing happen. I happened to be going through, flipping through Facebook, and there was a baseball card site that had, you know, like an old baseball card that I remember having as a kid. And, you know, whenever I see them, I go, hey, whatever happened to that person? And it happened to be Steve Garvey, who was the first baseman for the Dodgers back in the 70s and early 80s. And I go, gee, I wonder what happened to Steve Garvey. He was an all-star. He was a great player. So I said, I'll Google. I'll find out what happened to Steve Garvey. Evidently, this is so completely just out of the blue. I looked this up. Turns out today he announced that he's going to run for Senate in California as a Republican. It's just the weirdest kind of, you know, normally I looked him up and you go, oh, you know, he did this or did that. Or usually it's, you know, sadly, it's a lot of tragedy. But, you know, here, although this could be tragedy too. You know, you could end up with a crazy right winger. Who knows? But yeah, there you go. Steve Garvey's running for Senate in California. He's going to give the folks of left-leaning California, so the story goes, an opportunity to vote for their hero. Let's go to the phones. I got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane.
So what's on your mind?
So, well, you're complaining about right-wingers. I'm trying to be nice here.
Okay.
You know, they're just the most ignorant bunch, and they don't do research. And I've got a perfect example for you.
Hit me.
I think I've told you before about, you know, I've been involved in genealogy for years, you know, at least 20. And my cousin Jan, who lives in Seattle, Washington, has extensively researched, and I mean gone to the archives in D.C. and the whole nine yards, our family tree on the Adams-Wilson side. Now, I am of triracial heritage. I have Native American, African American, and, of course, Caucasian. So the Adam Wilsons is our mixed race side. So she sends me an email today, and she said, hey, did you go on Find a Grave and make an entry for a Jasper Denton Adams? And she proceeded to go on, and I guess whoever had made this had put down Denton's wife's name and connected it. So I went and hunted up, I said, who the heck did this? Because Jasper Adams would have been my two times great-grandfather. Jasper was his brother, and they both died at Andersonville prison camp in Georgia. Grandfather Denton had been captured at the Battle of the Wilderness, and Jasper had been captured before then. And they both had joined in Ohio and joined the infantry. So I sent this guy an email, and I said, look, you're thoroughly confused. You know, and I proceeded to tell him where he screwed up in the whole nine yards. And I said, you've got my cousin Jan upset too. Well, cousin Jan, being the researcher that she is, she went and found out that the guy who did this is some right-wing guy who is living in Mexico but is originally from Arkansas. who has put together and just totally screwed up all kinds of stuff on the family tree. So I was like, do these people not research? I mean, how hard is it?
No, yeah. No, look, they're just selling stuff. It's a product.
Yeah, it is, but I thought, you know, they can't research anything. My God, not even genealogy.
Well,
they got, you know, they've got...
That's why it's good to have you there to keep the tree well trimmed.
No, that's Cousin Jan. She's worse than I am. But have a good evening, Rick.
Thank you, Alice. Appreciate it. I'm terrible at that. I had a relative, you know, contact me the other day and ask me, you know, if I knew anything about, you know, this other side of our family. They had done one.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.